From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Writer Mario Vargas Llosa is one of the most respected men in Latin American literature. On this edition of Fresh Air, Vargas Llosa tells us what he thought of his recent foray into Latin American politics. He lost a bid to be president of Peru. Also today, we meet Mick Fleetwood, leader of the rock band Fleetwood Mac. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has an appreciation of soprano Eleanor Stieber, and we examine this week's developments in the ongoing controversy over government funding of the arts. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Speaker of Egypt's parliament was killed today in a machine gun ambush in Cairo. Rifat al-Mahjoub and four security men were gunned down by four assailants who escaped on motorcycles. Officials say they suspected either Muslim fundamentalists or terrorists from Iraq. Police have stepped up security in Cairo and placed airports on alert. The speaker was the second-ranking Egyptian politician after President Hosni Mubarak. The West German interior minister was shot and wounded by an unknown assailant this evening. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The West German government has confirmed that Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble was shot in the head this evening. The attack came during a public appearance in Oppenau in the southern part of Germany. Initial reports say the minister was seriously injured and was taken immediately to a nearby hospital. West German television has reported that one person was arrested after the attack and at least two others fled. Nothing is yet known about the motive for the attack. Last spring, the leading opposition candidate for chancellor, Oscar Lafontaine, was stabbed during an election appearance by a woman who proved mentally disturbed. He recovered from the injuries. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In Lebanon, the rebellious General Michel Aoun has escaped an assassination attempt. He was addressing a crowd of supporters outside his East Beirut headquarters when a man fired two shots at him, but hit a bodyguard instead. Mike Theodulu reports.
Soldiers and people in the crowd seized Aoun's assailant before he could fire again. Within minutes, Aoun reappeared to deliver a speech canvassing support against a possible Syrian attack. The tiny area he controls is surrounded by hostile forces after Lebanon's president, Ilyas Harawi, officially asked for Syria's help to oust him. Harawi doesn't command enough forces to take on the general himself. The identity of the attacker is not yet known. Aoun has many enemies, but it could have been an ordinary citizen who is tired of bloodshed and believes Aoun's defiance is about to bring on another round of violence. Despite the Syrian build-up, Aoun has vowed to fight to the end. After a day of mounting tension, there was a flare-up involving tanks between his soldiers and a rival Christian militia. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Palestinian leader George Habash said today that the PLO has given up trying to win concessions from the United States and should go back to its guerrilla war against Israel. Habash is the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. He spoke today after a meeting of the Palestine Liberation Organization's top leadership in Tunis. Habash told Reuters news agency that the Palestinian radicals will no longer rely on what he called Arab reactionaries like Egypt's Hosni Mubarak. Prices on Wall Street recovered a bit today after a three-day slide. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 33 points to close at 2,398. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. When Mario Vargas Llosa lost his bid for the presidency of Peru, the literary world breathed a sigh of relief. Instead of being bogged down with the details of running Peru's embattled government, Vargas Llosa could continue his writing. Mario Vargas Llosa is Peru's leading author. His books include The Storyteller, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, The Greenhouse, and several volumes of literary essays. Vargas Llosa's latest novel, In Praise of the Stepmother, has recently been translated into English. It explores the erotic relationship between the stepmother Doña Lucrecia, Don Rigoberto, her husband, and Alfonso, his pre-adolescent son. Erotica is a theme that has interested Vargas Llosa for some time now. He once said that he preferred pornography to science fiction. I asked him to explain.
Well, I wrote that in a context in which I was trying to explain why, in general, I was more sympathetic to concrete things and activities than to abstract ones. And I think that maybe pornography is much more concrete, let's say, than science fiction. The feeling of irreality is less in pornographic texts than in science fiction texts. But in general, I don't like pornography. I become very bored, you know, with pornographic texts because the poorness of their style, of their formal artistry.
Does it require a different kind of imagination to write erotica, something obviously different from pornography?
Well, you have to establish what is the difference between eroticism and pornography. I think the difference is that pornography is eroticism badly written, badly realized. I think an erotic story well written is eroticism. Badly written is pornography. I think this is the only, well, objective kind of differences that you can establish between eroticism and pornography.
And do they have different ends, do you think?
That is very difficult to say. What is the end of literature in general, of art in general? That's a very complicated theme. I don't think the aims are important, you know. I think what is really important in art is the realization. If you write a good novel, an important novel, something that enrich the language, the imagination, well, the results of this would be diverse, very different for different persons, for different times. And in any case, these results or consequences won't be those that the author project or wanted. You know, so I think what is important in art is the realization, the actual production of something that is authentic, creative, original, persuasive, beautiful. If you achieve this, I think the results would be positive in any way.
So for you, there's no different kind of approach to what you're writing if it is erotica versus anything else. I mean, what you're talking about is using the same kind of imagination, drawing from that same well of imagination.
I think so. But, you know, I accept to call this book an erotic novel because it is true that physical love has a major role in the story. But I am not in favor, you know, of this kind of labels put into novels, because this is a reduction of what a novel is. I think a novel, the nature of the genre is to embrace a wide variety of human experiences. I think this is what is connatural to the novel. And if you reduce a novel to the description of only one exclusive experience in the world, for instance, sex, physical love, you reduce the horizon, the scope of a genre which has been created to express the totality of the human experience. In my book, for instance, in Praise of the Stepmother, it is true, physical love is essential, but there are other aspects of experience which are also very important. Rituals, for instance. Well, the function of rituals in life. Utopias, the function of collectivistic and individual utopias in life. Painting, plastic imagination is something also important in the book. So it's not exclusively about physical love.
I would like you to read a passage from your book, and this is about Don Rigoberto performing one of his many rituals, and he has set aside certain evenings to attend to certain parts of his body, his nose, his skin, his feet, his hair. And in this passage, it's a ritual that he does to cleanse his ears, which you describe as conch shells.
Tonight, I shall not make love, but hear it, he decided. That was possible. He had done it so on other occasions, and it amused Lucrezia too, at least as part of the prolegomena. Let me hear your breasts, he would murmur, enamorously plugging his wife's nipples, first one and then the other, into the hypersensitive cavern of his 2 ears, which they fit into as snugly as a foot into a moccasins. He would listen to them with his eyes closed, reverent and ecstatic, his mind worshipfully concentrated as at the elevation of the host, till he heard ascending to the earthy rockness of each button from subterranean carnal depths certain stifled cadences, the heavy breathing perhaps of her pores opening, the boiling perhaps of her excited blood.
Do you think of cleansing or cleaning as an erotic act in itself?
Well, anything can be erotic, you know. We know now that sex is not something that can be exclusively related to sexual organs in the body. That sex is part of the totality of the human experience. And but in the case of Don Rigoberto, the character of this book, he has assumed this and has transformed this in a ceremony, in a ritual that he practices every day. He prepares himself to make love with his wife, cleaning his body, not in a purely functional way, but transforming this act in something that can have, let's say, religious overtones. It's a ceremony in which he participates with great love, concentration, enthusiasm, even a kind of a spiritual joy. He cleans his body to perform something that for him represents a kind of absolute. The happiness for Don Rigoberto comes through these secret ceremonies that he performs with himself alone and with his wife. He has built a kind of utopia, a private utopia, and he thinks that in this way he's been able to achieve happiness.
Getting back to what you were saying about rituals, is it the time that it takes to perform the ritual and for Don Rigoberto, the kind of secrecy involved in the ritual that makes it erotic?
Yes, I think this is an important aspect of eroticism, secrecy. Eroticism, I don't think it's something that can be called municipal or collectivistic. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably one of the moral justifications for eroticism. If we want to defend and to preserve the individual, and if we want the individual not to dissolve in the collective world, a risk that exists, particularly in modern industrial developed societies, we have to give to the individuals many reasons to defend his identity. And eroticism is one way of achieve this. Eroticism is something that has to do with individuals, not with masses, not with it's not a collective experiences.
I ask that because another part of your book is the game, in a sense, that's going on between the stepmother and the stepson. He is watching her as she makes love with her husband or as she takes a bath, and she knows that. And it's the relationship between the spyer and the spied. I'm interested in what it is about that relationship that you find interesting.
Well, What I think it's interesting in this relation, is the fact that it's very difficult to establish who seduces to whom in the book. Is it the child who seduces the stepmother? Because the child apparently is a very innocent boy, and he acts without, let's say, deliberation. He acts like boys used to do.
They're innocent hugs and kisses that he gives his stepmother.
He plays. He's something that apparently is very spontaneous. But you can discover there is probably very deep and hidden some malice in it. And on the other hand, the stepmother, in spite of herself, she has strong convictions, and she tries to not respond in a, let's say, in an erotic way to what is going on. In spite of that, she's pushed by something dark and hidden in herself, attraction of the risk, maybe, towards this relationship.
My guest is Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. His most recent book is In Praise of the Stepmother. We'll talk more about Vargas Llosa's novels and about his unsuccessful bid for the presidency of Peru after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Mario Vargas Llosa is my guest. His new book is In Praise of the Stepmother. You ran for president of Peru, and I'm curious whether this novel was being read in Peru while you were running your campaign.
It was published during the campaign, yes. And, it was even used by my adversary against me. There were programs in the television trying to prove that I was a pornographer, and so that it was a great risk to put a pornographer in the presidency. But I don't think it has much effect in the result of the election.
Well, I do have to laugh, because I think in our own presidential campaigns, we have politicians who are afraid to say the word taxes, much less to write about what you wrote about, the way you wrote about it.
Yes, well, I know that there is in the States a debate about problems of censorship, and something that I think it's a great pity, because on the other hand, United States is such a free society. You have this very refreshing feeling that here anything can be questioned, that you can have the opportunity to challenge everything that is established, and to... So I don't think how can this match with censor for art or for books. I hope this didn't prosper.
Are you at all relieved that you actually lost the election for president of Peru?
From a personal point of view, without any doubt, of course, because it would have been very, very difficult. I was disappointed because I had worked very hard with many people in order, to present a program of changes and... But from a personal point of view, I was very happy to be returned to my books, to my studio, to what is really my vocation. Politics was never my vocation. I accepted to run for moral reasons, not for political reasons.
Well, why did you want to be president? And are moral reasons then more important than personal ones in your country?
Well, you know, there are circumstances in the life of a nation in which everybody has the obligation to participate in politics, in social life, like it or not, because when I entered into politics, we were living in Peru, an atmosphere, you know, in which it seems that it was a great enthusiasm for the kind of liberal reforms that I think are necessary in order to overcome poverty, underdevelopment, barbarism. it was an illusion. It wasn't like that, you know. But that's what we thought, we believed, and it was so, I thought it was my obligation to try to do something about it.
Why do you think you lost?
Well, putting it simply, I think because there was a majority of Peruvians who were not prepared to accept the kind of society that we thought we need to create in order to become modern and prosperous. You know, they were afraid of this free market reform that would transfer all the public sector to the private initiative. And I think the populist tradition, which is very, very strong in Peru and in Latin America, prevailed at the end against the kind of liberalism that I was offering. So I think it was really an intellectual or even a philosophical choice. It was a choice against liberal, modern democracy and in favor of what has been the traditional mercantilist system that Peru and most Latin American countries have been had since, well, at least the beginning of the 19th century.
I think many people ask themselves more and more why anyone wants to run any country. And I know in Peru there's enormous problems of unemployment or underemployment, inflation, drought, drug trafficking, a guerrilla war. Could you have actually been still a novelist and tried to take care of some of these serious problems? And I guess I'm even comparing the sort of public life of the politician versus the private life that a writer needs.
No, if I had to win the election during the 5 years of the presidency, I would have been totally unable to write novels and to have any serious literary activity. No, I think there is total incompatibility. You know, you can't really do both things. They are identically absorbing. They require total dedication. No, I knew that, you know, and that was one of the reasons why I was so reluctant and why it took me some time to accept, you know, because I knew that it would have been for me at least 5 years without writing and probably without reading any interesting literary book, you know.
Well, our writer John Updike said that novelists see all sides of a subject that a politician only sees one. Do you agree with that? And would you have had a problem of almost too much vision?
Well, yes, you know, when you enter into politics, you think that politics is about ideas, about imagination, about values. And in fact, you discover that 99% of the time, politics is intriguing, you know, it's maneuvering, it's a very cynical game of maneuvering in order to conquest power. And this is probably the most depressing aspect of doing politics. On the other hand, you can't dismiss politics because if you want to change things in society, you have to pass through politics in order to do it. But you must know that politics is in itself something not only very dirty, but also very boring and very mediocre, and that you must have a tremendous conviction and make tremendous efforts and to use all kind of skills if you don't want to be destroyed and mediocrized by the practical politics.
Do writers and poets in Central America, South America, in Peru have more status? I mean, does their word count for something more than the politicians' words? Because I think in this country, we can't trust what we hear anymore from politicians. And I think with a writer, there has to be a kind of trust between the reader and the writer, and that trust comes through those words. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, I think it is true. In Latin America, writers, poets enjoy a kind of respectability for what they say in no literary matters, you know. They are supposed to give advice and ideas and suggestions practically about everything. This is the old romantic idea of the writer, as somewhat with answers for all the questions of humanity. It's a very naive vision, no? It's a very naive, it's not true that writers have answers for everything. But it's a very, I think, exciting idea of literature. It's the idea that in literature you can find answers for everything. And this, I think, in a way, is true. I think good books, great poems, marvelous novels give you answers for many, many things that you in daily life don't know how to solve.
Can you then do more as a writer than you could have done as a president?
Oh, well, without any doubt. The problem is that there are moments in which the things that are needed to be done should be done rapidly, immediately, in collective terms, in economic and social terms. And this is not the way in which books influence and change society. I am convinced that books are not gratuitous, that a good book is something that has a lasting effect in a society. But let's use a very graphic example. If you were a French writer in 1939, when the Nazi armies invaded France, well, at that moment, the problem was to fight and to defend France, democracy against Nazism. And the way to do it was not to write poems, you know. You can write poems, of course, and it's fine. But at that moment, what was necessary was a more effective and concrete action. I think this is not diminishing in any way the role of literature, but literature change things slowly, changing people who read and changing the way of thinking and the way of perceiving things by people. And there are circumstances in which this is not enough, you know.
Novelist Mario Vargas Llosa, his new book is In Praise of the Stepmother. One of Vargas Llosa's earlier novels, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, is being made into a film. It stars Barbara Hershey and Peter Falk. Next time, film director Philip Kaufman. His new movie, Henry and June, is about the writers Henry Miller and Anais Nin. It stars Fred Ward and Uma Thurman. Kaufman also directed The Right Stuff and The Unbearable Lightness of Being. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Mick Fleetwood says he has a very simple drumming style. That may be true, but there's an awful lot of drummers that wish that they could play like him. Coming up, Mick Fleetwood tells us about his 20 years leading the rock group Fleetwood Mac. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers soprano Eleanor Stieber, who died earlier this month. Lloyd says we've lost one of the very best singers this country ever produced. And reporter Stefan Salisbury brings us up to date on the controversy surrounding government funding of the arts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. German Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble has been shot and seriously wounded at a German election campaign gathering in the southern part of the country. Police say that he was struck by one or more bullets, and a suspect has been taken into custody. Two other suspects are believed to have left the scene of the shooting. It's believed the Interior Minister was seriously injured in the attack, which took place about 130 miles south of Frankfurt. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein threatened Western leaders today by saying that he would hold them personally responsible for the death of any Iraqi children due to food shortages. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Amman.
Saddam Hussein revived his war of words with the West, saying he'd hold President Bush and other leaders personally responsible for any deaths of children in Iraq due to a UN embargo. It's a threat the Iraqi president has made before. Saddam Hussein also threatened Israel again, saying its occupation of the occupied territories was responsible for oppression and crimes against Palestinian children. Those words found a welcome reception today in Jordan, where 15,000 people demonstrated on behalf of Arabs killed in Old Jerusalem on Monday. But the war of words wasn't confined to the Middle East. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher said the military option remained open against Saddam. One cannot appease dictators, she said, only crush them. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
In Paris, a French news magazine reported today that the Pentagon has drawn up plans for a four-day offensive to free Kuwait and defeat Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
L'Express says the Pentagon plan is called Operation Night Camel. Quoting an unnamed aide to U.S. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, it says the operation would begin on a moonless night in November and would involve a four-day air raid against Iraq. The report says the plan would begin with attacks by U.S. stealth bombers against Iraqi radar and military sites. The last stage, it says, would be the entry into Kuwait of Arab forces stationed in Saudi Arabia. But L'Express says Washington is hesitating to go ahead with the plan for fear it would cost some 20,000 U.S. lives. Officials at the U.S. Embassy here have refused to comment on the report. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Officials in Germany and Belgium have announced that their diplomats have left Kuwait. Diplomats from countries that oppose Iraq's invasion of Kuwait have tried to stay, but electricity and water have been shut off to most of them, and there is a lack of food. Meanwhile, officials in Iraq say that they may stop Soviet detainees from returning home if they know about Iraqi weapons systems. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 33 points to close at 2,398.02, on volume of some 185 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, I'll talk with drummer Mick Fleetwood about the band he co-founded, Fleetwood Mac. On another musical front, the great American soprano Eleanor Stieber died on October 3rd of heart failure at the age of 76, 2.5 months after heart surgery. She was most famous as a star of the Metropolitan Opera. Between 1940 and 1962, she sang 33 roles at the Met. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, who saw Stieber in person only a few times, says she was one of the very greatest singers this country ever produced.
I remember the first time I saw Eleanor Stieber in person. It wasn't at the Met, but at MIT, in a concert performance of Mozart's Idomeneo. She was clearly past her radiant vocal prime, but her performance of the embittered Electra was hair-raising. Stieber never stinted in her life or in her art. Even toward the end of her career, she sang with everything she had. Perhaps this was part of what it meant to come of age as an American singer in a world in which American singers were still not quite taken seriously. You never felt that she was saving herself or protecting a precious commodity. So even though she was an elegant singer, one of the century's great Mozart singers, she could always convey the passion and urgency that lie just beneath the exquisite surface of classical formality. For Stieber, elegance and passion were not mutually exclusive. Here she is in one of her greatest roles, the Countess in The Marriage of Figaro. This is from a live performance conducted by Bruno Walter at the Met in 1944. Stieber had a long career and an impressive range, from the most delicate French art songs to Puccini's Madame Butterfly and Marie in Berg's Wozzeck. She didn't make an enormous number of recordings, though. A handful of complete operas, several recital albums, including some on her own label, Stand, and a late recording of the most notorious event in her career, the Black Tie, Black Towel concert at New York's Continental Baths, the gay health club where Bette Midler got her start. Stieber was one of the great non-French interpreters of French music, especially of Berlioz. Her landmark recording of his sublimely romantic song cycle Nuit d'été is the standard by which all other performances must be judged. Stieber also championed American music, and she put her money quite literally where her mouth was by commissioning Samuel Barber's elegiac setting of James Agee's Knoxville, Summer of 1915. She sang the first performance with Serge Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony in 1948. Her 1963 Columbia recording of this piece, which I played at the beginning, is probably her most famous. Few of Stieber's recordings are currently available. In 1958, Stieber created the title role in Barber's opera Vanessa, the original cast recording from the Met, made shortly after the world premiere, is now an RCA Victor CD. A videotape of some of Stieber's appearances on the early TV opera series, The Voice of Firestone, has been released by Video Artists International. On it, she sings a wide selection from Mozart and Verdi to Victor Herbert, Rodgers and Hammerstein, and Cole Porter. The Stieber video has been so successful that two more of her Voice of Firestone videos are already in the works. Stieber called herself the little girl from Wheeling, West Virginia. No one who ever experienced her glorious voice, the joy she took in singing, or her American generosity of spirit is likely to forget her.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Eleanor Stieber died of heart failure on October 3rd at the age of 76. This is Fresh Air. One of the most dramatic soap operas of rock and roll has been the history of the band Fleetwood Mac. It's a story of sexual intrigue, psychoses, money woes, and drugs. And it's all told in the new book, Fleetwood, My Life and Adventures in Fleetwood Mac, written by my guest, Mick Fleetwood. Fleetwood Mac was founded in England in 1967 by guitarist, singer, and songwriter Peter Green. But 3 years later, Green quit the group to join a fundamentalist religious cult. Bassist John McVie's wife, Christine, became the band's new singer. Then guitarist Jeremy Spencer disappeared and was founded a Children of God commune. In the mid-70s, the band hired Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks, two songwriters and singers who contributed a new pop sound to the band and led them to superstardom. But the pressures of this fame led to the breakup of all their relationships. They continued to record and tour together, fueled on by new love affairs and drugs. The turmoil of this time surfaced in many of the songs on their best-selling album, Rumors. Fleetwood Mac has a new album, Behind the Mask, and they'll begin a tour next week. Christine McVie and Stevie Nicks say it will be their last, but Mick Fleetwood says that the band will continue. I asked Fleetwood how he first started drumming.
I became aware that I wanted to be a drummer when I was about 9 years old, and I got my first drum kit a few years later. My father, who was not, quote, a drummer, he had an amazing sense of rhythm, not only with his hands, but he also wrote as well, and his poetry and the way he reads. I was very lucky. Before he passed away, he recorded everything, so his cadence has an uncanny knack. In fact, so much so that I've actually cut a couple of drum tracks playing to him, and he's absolutely perfectly in time. But he used to play at parties and things on bottles, you know, with different levels of water, and play with bits of change in his pocket, you know, tapping money in his pocket. That's about as near as I can get to any reason why I would be obsessed with wanting to be a drummer at that age. And I really was. I was determined to be a drummer, and I had this sort of dream, if you like, that increasingly got more and more feverish, which led up to me leaving school when I was 15 years old.
Let me just backtrack a little bit there, because I know that you had learning problems in school. You didn't often even stay in school. You ran away from the boarding schools that your parents sent you to. But I'm wondering how your problems with learning, whatever they were, actually affected your ability to play drums, or even if you did have true learning disabilities, if that's something you've had to compensate for, even playing drums.
It's definitely affected, and I go into that in the book a little bit, that and it's turned out sort of to my advantage, because I happen to play in a very simplistic fashion, and it's, I suppose one could say, which was certainly something that Peter Green, who started Fleetwood Mac, recognized about my playing, which happened to be and is very suited to, especially to playing blues formatted music, where you play from your heart, you know, versus trying to be some show off some technical prowess, which is usually a waste of time as far as I'm concerned. Thank you.
felt in those early days that the band would fall apart if you didn't all live together. And you, I believe, bought a house in the country and everyone kind of moved in together.
Benny Folds, yeah.
Yeah.
That's very true. And before that, we actually rented a house which was very close to Benny Folds, called Kiln House, which was the first album we made without Peter Green. And we were a sort of a bunch of lost souls, really, without our leader, our mentor, that Peter Green most certainly was. He was a very powerful young man. And, yes, I thought it was very important for, at that point, to be together. Otherwise, I think I had feelings that the whole thing might just drift apart.
And people have come in and out of the band, and you mentioned Peter Green and others that have really taken a kind of downturn, I guess, as a result or after having been with Fleetwood Mac. What happened with him?
Well, Peter became disenchanted. He was a very ambitious young fellow, young man, in the healthiest possible sense of the word. Because he was very generous in terms of he was on no ego trip, I can assure you, musically or otherwise. But he knew what he had, and he got it. Because you have to remember, Fleetwood Mac was very successful before Rumours in Europe. And he basically let the very thing that he created turn against him. And he became something. He had a tremendous presence, and as such, really had a power. I truly believe he had a real power that ended up freaking him out. And he did dabble, not a lot, but there again, who's to say? In fact, he said it himself on a BBC documentary a couple of years ago. And he said, well, I think I just took too much acid, you know, and that was the end of it. And I'm not suggesting that he's a throffing idiot, because he's not, but he's a changed person that no longer really functions in any shape or form in the way that he did before. You know, it's a bit upsetting.
How much were drugs a part of the musical life of Fleetwood Mac?
During the Rumours days, it was very much so. It was a real drug fest, fully confessional. And the ensuing roller coaster that continued for several years was also a drug fest.
And the roller coaster, you mean the kind of...
Just the carryings on of, I mean, from Rumours. You have to remember that album surpassed anyone's wildest dreams. It set all sorts of records in terms of sales and God knows what. We were public domain. Our private lives were very literally like an open book. And that's what I'm construing as a roller coaster. We lived very high on the hog when we worked. We traveled in grand style, and we had a lot of fun. And in writing this book, it was somewhat sobering when you go, like, oh my God, were we actually doing that? And you realize that you were, and sustaining it for years, really.
What was going on between all the members of the group, is Stevie Nicks and others as well, yourself included?
Going on?
Hmm.
Apart from... The I presume you're maybe asking about relationships. Our emotional
life was
in complete disarray. Absolutely, ridiculous. I was spared. My marriage broke up. I was spared the sort of misery of having to be around someone you either loved or had fallen out of love with, which was the case with Stevie and Lindsay and Chris and John. And ironically enough, the band itself became the catalyst that pulled us all through, amazingly enough.
Well, I wonder, even as your wife was having an affair with Bob Weston, who played with the band, how you could get up on stage with him. The kind of discipline.
That wasn't too pretty, no. I attempted to put the old English stiff upper lip attitude and to try and finish the tour. But I have to confess that I did it for about a month, a little over a month or so, when I realized the chips were down. And I just said, I'm in danger of losing the old faculties here. I think I've got to say this is enough.
Did you feel, though, that you need some, you needed some level of turbulence and upset to be creative, and that somehow out of all this energy would come a more creative kind of music?
Well, the fact of the matter, it did. I mean, specifically, of course, like during the Rumours, the making of that album, it has to be the best exponent of a lot of the emotion that we got was going on, made its way onto the old vinyl. But a great deal of the time, you don't have to delve very far into many of the great artists and poets and writers, and you usually find that there's a good chunk of self-destructive motivation going on, and that's just a fact of life. I think often in times of duress, it seemingly some of the best work can come out, and that just is part of life.
Mick Fleetwood's new book is Fleetwood, My Life and Adventures in Fleetwood Mac.
You can go your own way.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. On our program tonight, more stories, of course, about the budget compromise process going on in Washington. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports from Zimbabwe about government efforts there to stop the poaching of black rhinos. The poachers thought to be coming from across the border in Zaire. The Egyptian Speaker of the Parliament is assassinated in Cairo. It's speculated that a radical Palestinian group could be responsible. Also, I'll talk with Catherine Weiler, the co-producer of the new movie Memphis Belle. It's the story of the last flight of a B-17 bomber on a bombing run over Bremen, Germany.
Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the past week, the controversy swirling around art, obscenity, and the National Endowment for the Arts has perhaps reached a turning point. Thursday evening, the House of Representatives voted to reauthorize the endowment for 3 years. They decisively rejected the idea of imposing heavy restrictions on the kind of art funded by the endowment. But the reauthorization does allow the endowment to recoup grant money if a work is judged obscene by the courts. Just a week ago, a jury in Cincinnati acquitted an art museum of obscenity charges arising from an exhibition of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs. Stephen Salisbury was in Cincinnati and in Washington covering the story for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he joins us here in the studio. Stephen, I'm wondering, given all the publicity about government funding of supposedly obscene and blasphemous art, was the House vote rejecting restrictions a surprise to you?
Yeah, it was a surprise to me, and I think it surprised a lot of people. Dana Rohrabacher, a conservative Republican, had proposed a long list of restrictions on endowment work. He wanted to prohibit everything from obscenity to art employing fetal tissue. Before the vote, he was telling everyone that he had a majority to push it through. That didn't happen. On the other hand, Pat Williams and Tom Coleman, who authored the compromise bill that did finally pass, were saying that they were unsure if they had the votes. Their proposal was approved overwhelmingly. Williams said that 6 months ago, when reauthorization was first taken up in his subcommittee, he thought a vote favoring an unrestricted endowment wasn't possible. A lot of congressmen, I'd say, were finally persuaded that the endowment was a pretty good agency, as federal agencies go anyway, and heavy restrictions on the kind of art it funds were not worth all the negative charges of censorship. There's also a strong feeling, believe me, that this debate has been interminable.
Do you think the verdict in Cincinnati had any effect on Congress?
Oh, there's no question about that. The exhibition of Mablethorpe photographs was funded in part by the endowment, and it's been a thorn in the endowment's side ever since Jesse Helms denounced Mablethorpe as a pornographer in the Senate last year. But now a jury of ordinary people in a town that has a reputation for aggressive smut-busting has said that Mablethorpe may have taken some nasty pictures, but they're not obscene. That verdict came up several times during the House debate. Conservatives argued that it showed you couldn't trust the courts to take action against sexually explicit work. Endowment supporters argued that the Cincinnati verdict showed that the whole endowment debate is overheated, if not ridiculous, and it's being manipulated by right-wingers for their own purposes.
How do you think artists and art organizations will react to this House bill, or how are they reacting?
Well, I think it's safe to say they aren't thrilled with it. They say it invites right-wing groups who are unhappy with the endowment to bring obscenity charges in court. Artists are also leery of a number of internal reforms called for in the legislation. They say those reforms will dilute the authority of the panels of experts that recommend endowment grants and therefore will dilute the effectiveness of the endowment itself. There's also a question of whether private funders are going to be flocking to support controversial work now. We'll have to wait and see.
So what happens next?
Well, the Senate has a bill that's similar to this House measure that's been reported out of committee. It hasn't been scheduled for a floor vote. The one wild card, of course, is what Senator Helms will do, and he's keeping his own counsel. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, Stephen, thanks. Stephen Salisbury covers cultural affairs for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our interviews this week were produced by Amy Sallet and Joan Tuohy, with help from Chris Spurgeon, Roberta Shorrock, and Mary Van Voorst, who joined us for the week. Thanks, Mary. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wade.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, filmmaker Philip Kaufman. His new movie, Henry and June, is the first film to be rated NC-17. Also, Paul Westerberg of the rock band The Replacements on why it can be good to play bad. That and more next time on Fresh Air.